Wherever we find liquid water on Earth, we find life. And it appears that Earth life has very similar constraints in terms of the chemicals that it uses, the metabolism, DNA for information. It uses water as a solvent. There are a lot of these common elements. And so when we think about the search for life in the universe, we start with life as we know it. But obviously, astronomers and astrobiologists are thinking about how could we figure out life as we don't know it. So my guest today is Dr. Ricard Solé. He is an IKREA research professor at the University of Pompeu Fabra and the leader of the Complex System Lab. And he released a new paper with his researchers about the fundamental logic of life. When you strip life down to the very basic laws of physics, the laws of chemistry, when you think about the fundamental principles of heat, of information transfer, of cognition, of cellular structure, what are the ways that life could take based on just the laws of physics? And that gives you some really interesting predictions for what you should see when you look for life. And so in my interview with Dr. Solé, we talk about those fundamental constraints and what we could expect to see for life both here on Earth, across the solar system, and across the cosmos. So enjoy this interview with Dr. Ricard Solé. Ricard, we always hear that astrobiologists are searching for life as we know it, because wherever we find water on Earth, we find life. But, you know, often people are accused of just being too closed-minded and they're not thinking about life as we don't know it. So what do you think are the fundamental constraints when you think about life itself that should sort of guide our view and our search for life, both here on Earth and in the cosmos?
Yeah, I mean, this my answer has a lot of speculation behind, but I will say that I'm sure this is a lot of space for variability and diversity in life somewhere else. But if you think in terms of what is expected in terms of the very general principles that might guide life elsewhere, if these principles exist, it turns out that if we think kind of in depth about what seems to be universal in life in our planet, having in mind that our planet has billions of years of evolving complexity, a lot of different kinds of complexity have evolved. In many, many cases, we observe the same basic design principles in terms of the logic, the fundamental logic. And so if you ask me about if these general principles that have to do with information, with the kind of complex structures that can be formed all the way up into ecosystem organization, it might be the case, and that's the conjecture we formulated recently, that in terms of the logic, the fundamental logic, maybe this is universal and should be expected to be found out elsewhere, which also has an implication for our attempts to build a synthetic life, both from basic protocells to complex forms of life. I mean, thinking in organs, organoids, things like that. There may be, if these principles operate, that means that our capacity for bioengineering life may also be strongly limited.
So in your paper, you identify a bunch of these potential factors for this logic of life. And I'd love to talk about each one of them because they all affect the way life works here on Earth. And we can sort of imagine how they might affect life on other worlds. So can we talk about some of these, you know, like thermodynamics, for example, and I'd love to sort of go through each one. You know, talk about thermodynamics, information, sort of materials, and each one has some really interesting implications. So could we start and just chat about thermodynamics as it relates to life?
Yes, we start from that because in a way it's kind of a very fundamental baseline and to understand complexity and what is to be expected. And that's actually an old story. We know from non-equilibrium thermodynamics in several decades of work that life is an out-of-equilibrium system, that in order to maintain complex structures, you have to take free energy from the environment and use that to reduce your internal entropy, whereas you increase the entropy so that the whole balance is fulfills the second law. And one particular thing that we highlight, because there's a number of systems that you can find out outside that are in non-equilibrium state. Actually, the biosphere and all the geosphere, in a way, is an out-of-equilibrium system. But you do can identify some particular things that seem to be very much universal in living systems, which, for example, the presence of cycles, of metabolic cycles in particular. And that comes from an idea from Harold Morowitz, who proved that you are in an out-of-equilibrium conditions, but you have to maintain stable structures, kind of a stationary state. You had to expect to observe cycles that, you know, take energy and matter and go into a whole cycle to create structure. So that would be one probably inescapable universality of living systems. That, of course, doesn't mean that we can detect that using our future telescopes. But that's a clear constraint that you had to expect to be observable.
I mean, I know there's some sort of recent ideas about the very limits of industrial pollution and such here on Earth, that we may reach some point in the future where even if we're trying to be the most sustainable possible using only solar energy and we're not producing additional greenhouse gases, we're still going to be releasing waste heat into our environment that will raise the temperature on the planet. And that's the kind of thing that you can imagine someone looking in a telescope and seeing planets that are out of thermal equilibrium. But I guess if we take a rover to Mars, or if we have a submarine on Europa that's looking for places that are out of thermal equilibrium, we could see that at the micro scale as well.
Yeah, I will expect to observe some kind of processes that might identify, maybe indirectly, the presence of living structures. But it's a tricky thing, unless we can actually be sure that this is another equilibrium. And I think we learned some lessons, for example, when we had these samples from Mars that appear to be kind of protocell structures. And in reality, we know now, and that kind of triggered a lot of attention to supramolecular chemistry and what kind of actual spatial structures you might be able to generate from chemistry that is not alive. So that's one of the challenges we have, that to find out the signatures correctly.
Right. I mean, so I sort of think of examples like you could have some kind of event that brings two chemicals together, and now the chemicals are reacting, and that's creating some kind of process that is out of balance. Or maybe, you know, the times when Earth has had a natural radioactive pile where uranium is starting to cook, and you get this release of heat and various particles. You can imagine there are these situations, and so it's hard to distinguish between the ones that are natural and the ones, you know, it's back to, you know, can you find a true biosignature? Well, let's move on then. And let's talk about this idea of information itself, you know, that life on Earth is classified by DNA, and that you would sort of like, what are the fundamental limits for information transfer?
Yes. We bring this idea by actually asking people, if you had to think in the simplest kind of system that will be able, at the molecular level, to store information that can be read. So you need to read the information so that makes sense. It can be adaptive. And it's easy for people to end up in thinking in a linear polymer. And it depends who you ask. If you ask a computer scientist, will say, well, a Turing machine kind of system, right? You have string, and you have a machine that reads the string and reads and writes. And a biologist will say, well, you know, I have a number of examples from within cells, which are essentially a string of monomers forming a linear polymer. And these are read by machines, molecular machines. A very interesting kind of convergence here, which I don't try to push much further. But in reality, if you consider this, the possible spectrum of things that can be able to store the information, and having the constraint that this information has to be accessible. And I use the example, for example, of tree rings. Tree rings, in a way, contain information. We can read this history of the tree. The tree is unable to use it. So it's not an information that has any adaptive kind of meaning in that respect. So you need to be able to read. And what we defend is that the perfect candidate for that is something that in chemistry happens to occur, which is polymers. And that polymers that can be, in a way, read by some machine that is able to not only take the information but unfold in new ways, it's something that defines the minimal baseline for that. And that has an important consequence, interestingly, because a linear polymer means that the monomers have to be able to bind with two networks, and is not a very big repertoire of possibilities here. I mean, it might happen that chemists find out something, but right now, something that can happen in prebiotic conditions that allows to build the polymers is amino acids. Not so good candidates because, you know, proteins fold. But there's nucleic acids, and nucleotides are the minimal building blocks. So it's a very big saying there, which is that on the basis of the logic, linear polymer, it's kind of what is needed, is a must, and it might put very strong constraints into what is possible chemically. I don't want to say that DNA is what you expect to find out in another planet, but maybe something familiar.
Right. And you sort of identify this as a one-dimensional information structure that, yes, that having this linear path that you're reading this information along is the most efficient way. And then when you think about the kinds of molecules that could come together to form a one-dimensional linear information tape, you're limited by the kinds of chemicals that could come together to actually produce that. And yes, DNA is a beautiful version that nature has come up with.
Yes, exactly. And also, there's two things to say. One, the fact that you have a linear polymer actually puts a big constraint that makes it very reliable to read and write, because you are constrained to the one dimension. And the second thing is that you can think. And mathematicians have been thinking about, for example, Turing machines that have a two-dimensional tape. You can think about that. But as soon as you go into reality and think, what if I had a system that is made by a two-dimensional substrate? There's plenty of problems. It's really plenty of problems. And one of them is, if you want to store the information in that two-dimensional surface, for example, you have to figure out a lot of important cost constraints and to organize the information correctly, and not to mention how to read that in a reliable way. Right? So linear is the top candidate.
Right. I mean, I think about like a hard drive, and in the old versions of hard drives, you know, you'd have this two-dimensional surface and you'd have the read head that was moving around and the platter was spinning, and it would be able to sort of access different parts of the information. But there's, you know, there's a lot of machinery and stuff going on there, but the underlying program that is being executed is still linear. It's still a Turing machine that is accessing this memory. Yes. And the two are very different. So, I mean, do we use two-dimensional even computing? Do, you know, as you say, is there such a thing as a two-dimensional Turing computer?
I don't think so.
Yeah. So I can see. So, you know, you look at DNA with its, you know, with the molecules that make up the structure. You must have sort of sat and thought about, like, what else gets us a linear Turing machine, but could still be possible, right?
Yes.
Have you thought about that?
And how we know from computational theory that, I mean, you can add this two-dimensional tape, etc., but there's no further improvement. So the universality of the Turing machine is fulfilled, but in the one-dimensional case scenario. So it's not anything really interesting to add if you make more complex the machine.
You make it longer, right. but then that introduces new constraints that kind of come back to your original idea about the logic of life.
Yes. Exactly.
So, I mean, are there any other chemicals that people have identified that could replace what DNA does in this sort of linear Turing machine fashion?
I mean, as far as I know, I mean, people can argue that we still might miss something really relevant from the chemical space, which in principle is astronomically large. But I will say my argument, so the answer to the question is no. I mean, it's not so far. My argument about the other possibilities, which, I mean, people sometimes brings a silicon base, which has a lot of problems. In particular, you don't have diversity within polymers, which effectively it cancels information storage. But again, one of the arguments I think that can be made is that it's interesting that on our planet, which had a lot of opportunities for finding out very diverse ways of storing information and coding information, we went into the same solution. So that's kind of suspicious.
Okay, so let's talk about cells. Next, what do you sort of see as the fundamental logic of cell structure?
Okay, there's one observation, which is all life in our planet is built in terms of fundamental units with cells. This can be individual cells that have some kind of autonomy or in the cells that are part of an organism in a multicellular system. But as a building block, that's what we have. So the question you might raise is, could be life somewhere else? Or that we can build in a lab, not based on these closed systems that differentiate the inside from the outside and that have all these amazing advantages. Like, for example, because you have a membrane, you can actually define gradients, and the gradients immediately provide the source for non-equilibrium conditions that you can exploit. And one of the things we mentioned, we mentioned that repeatedly in different instances, is the visionary precursors of this idea. And for Neumann in particular, at some point, at the end of his life, he was very interested in biology. It's a pity that he didn't live more, because he was really interested in topics that now are so important, like the brain and life. And he was thinking in terms of, as a mathematician, in terms of what would be needed for a machine to replicate itself. And that's, of course, a very abstract question and was formulated years ahead of molecular biology, before we knew anything about DNA and regulation and anything. And beautifully, he ends up in this diagram where he says that the machine has to contain the information that describes the construction. And when you build the new machine, you make a copy, the information has to be copied with the machine. And that has to happen with some units that they call the duplicator, the controller, et cetera, et cetera. You show this diagram to a biologist, immediately comes from, I know what you're talking about. This is a cell, right? The information that plays the role of software, but has to be copied, that has hardware, is DNA. The duplicator is the polymerases, and so on and so forth. So years ahead, molecular biology, we knew anything really about the logic of cell replication. Von Neumann stumbled into exactly the logic of that. We use that to kind of say, because this happens repeatedly in different situations, to say that that might be because the logic of replication, as defined by cells as fundamental units, is probably something that is maybe even beyond the exact nature of the cells. What are they making of? It's something that is the fundamental logic. What do you need? You need information that has to have this dual role and a number of mechanisms that guarantees the whole copy with information. So it might be the case that the logic of cells is something that is fundamentally universal, which I think is very important. And that this is coupled with the nature of cells that are closed membranes. And then we have a whole bunch of other things that come from soft matter about what is possible and what is not. And the whole package will point out into, if we find out life somewhere else, is going to be based on cells as fundamental units.
And then when we sort of extend this idea to multicellular organisms, and, you know, potentially they have increased capacity for being able to affect their environment. You know, I know that biologists don't like to think that say human beings are more evolved than bacteria. Bacteria are in this gauntlet all the time, that they've evolved endlessly and many more repetitions than say human beings have had a chance to evolve, but that there is more capacity to affect your environment when you start to have these multicellular organisms where they start to break down the tasks. But do we still see those fundamental limits? Like I'll give you sort of an example. I think about, you know, my nerve cells are different from my liver cells, and yet the beginning, you know, when I was a embryo and made of stem cells, I had to maintain the recipe for both of those types of cells in that original part that you could then turn into that multicellular organism. And so do we see this sort of logic continue where you have this individuals, you know, single-celled organisms versus multicellular organisms?
Yeah, well, you're bringing a lot of stuff here. On the one hand, I mean, is of course this requirement for multicellularity of having an organization that allows the propagation, to have new organisms that start from one cell to repeat the whole thing, which is something that I have seen this so many times that I still find it totally amazing. Multicellularity, as you mentioned, provides the clues of complexity. There's a lot of discussion about how to treat the idea of what's more complex or less complex. But it's clear that multicellularity is a beautiful example of a side of complexity that seems to follow this general rule that you can evolve complexity provided that the new system is capable of reducing the uncertainty of the environment, which is a way of saying predicted. Which that can happen because you, as you kind of mentioned, you affect the environment, so you're able to kind of modify it to your own needs. For humans, that's the extended mind. We have done this on a massive scale. And in general, if you think in the simplest cases, the first multicellular organisms, there's this idea that you can actually compute your world in a way that, despite you are more costly, in the end, the cooperation among units makes everyone gaining a lot. So it's really worth to achieve this complexity. The case of the brain is the most spectacular example. Why brains? You could say, right? Because this has a lot of cost. Yes, but the potential for predicting and kind of managing what kind of future scenarios might be there makes, in terms of information, makes you extremely powerful in terms of survival.
Now, I let my patron members know that I was going to be interviewing you, and I got a couple of questions from them, which I will be sprinkling in as we continue this conversation. But this question comes from Douglas M. Smith. What similarities do you find between computer programming and the genetic mechanisms in a living cell?
Wow, this is a big question, because, I mean, one of the things that has been debated a lot is to what extent we can make a map between what is our understanding of programming, and in particular, the distinction between hardware and software, which it seems within cells and living structures is very much blurred, because hardware and software are pretty much mixed up. And sometimes also you find out aspects of computation that we don't see in standard, say, machines. So what I mean by that is that even, for example, and that Michael Levine and others have explored this idea of polycomputation, you can actually have properties that have to do with the embodiment, the way in which matter is organized and adapts in time, that contain some kind of computation. So it's a whole story to discuss. For many people also is the idea that cells are really not machines in a number of ways. But that's a whole discussion.
So you suggest that there are different solutions that life can discover. Like, what are the limits, do you think, for, you know, when we look at the current ecosystems on Earth, we look at the kinds of solutions that life has come up with to solve these problems. Is that the entire toolkit and life is deploying them all across the world? Or do you think that there are solutions to problems that life has just not figured out yet so far? Because, you know, like, I know you go into these evolutionary, you go into these local minima where you're trapped in a certain solution to the problem, and yet there could be other problems. You're unable to evolve your way out of it. Do you think that life has figured out all of the tricks, or most of the tricks, or a fraction of the tricks?
Okay, so we need to figure out. If we are right, and there's really a very strong constraint to the logic, which means the fundamental generative rules, the fundamental ways in which information is coded, etc. Our stance is like, yes, life has explored that in our planet. But this, of course, is under a set of if you want, physico-chemical conditions that might be affected by the ways in which a given planet forms, what's the accessibility for some elements. So there are parts of our argument that, you know, need to be really explored, and you probably need to merge different areas of knowledge to get into the answers. But the question is relevant and can be reformulated in a number of ways. One, for example, and that's why in my lab we have this synthetic biology lab where we use synthetic biology to interrogate precisely that question. When you look, for example, at the space of possibilities of, I don't know, organs and organoids and things like that, you organize this in a cube with computation and state of matter and development, for example. One of the things you find is that there are big voids. There are parts of this space that have not been covered by biology. Biology has not been able to get there. And the question is, why is that? It could be because it's forbidden somehow, maybe physics and chemistry. That doesn't seem to be the case. Is this because evolution has not been able to get there? We want to explore that. Still an open question. Some things seem to be achievable by engineering. So evolution cannot get there, but we might get there. But on the other hand, I want to point out that one of the things that we see massively in the evolution of life in the biosphere is convergence. This observation that exactly the same solutions are found repeatedly in totally independent ways through the evolution, which shouldn't be the case, right? For example, you take octopi, right? They have evolved in a totally independent way within invertebrates. But you end up with a complex organism that has eyes, camera eyes like ours, brains, which essentially recapitulate the organization of our brains, not only neurons, but even the whole organization, and a set of behavioral patterns that we can easily identify and recognize. So it shouldn't be the case, could be totally different, but it's not. So I think that this tells us something about what's possible.
You make this distinction between contingency and convergence. Mm-hmm. So can you sort of explain what you mean by that?
Yes, within evolutionary biology, but in a way in physics also, because it's a very important kind of dichotomy of views. On the one hand, evolution is a historical process, it's no doubt. I mean, the chain of events happens through time, and it's easy to argue that because it's historical, it has to be very contingent, that it's very much history dependent, and that's what Stephen Jay Gould pointed out. He was pretty much convinced that if we were able to went back in time and make the tape of evolution run again from, for example, the Precambrian, the world will be totally different, kind of an alien world, because contingency is so important. The other side of the story, which we think can be pretty well defended because of convergence, is that the biosphere doesn't tell that story. in terms of the actual structures that you observe. You see, as I was saying before, you see that repeatedly you find the same solutions in totally independent scenarios. Like pointing that not everything is possible, and meaning that if that's correct, and artificial life brings ideas about that, if we repeat the experiment, we'll observe a biosphere that will be different, but clearly familiar. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, there's the examples of wings, you know, there's plenty of examples of how you have this convergent evolution. And I've interviewed people in the past talking even about multicellular life. Now, you know, we're all, you know, we all come from a common ancestor and a common multicellular ancestor, but that you can push cells in the lab to go multicellular almost at will at this point. And so clearly evolution has probably tried that many times in the past. I've got another question from Powell Pewick, who asks, what is our current understanding of how many times life started on Earth?
Okay. That means early life events that, we don't know. We don't have an answer for that, unfortunately. There's people that is maintaining the idea that life might have emerged several times, which might be the case, but it's also possible that maybe it emerged once, and that whatever made it so powerful as a propagating system kind of invaded the whole planet. And then there's people which actually argue that even it can be happening right now, that life is might be kind of re-originating. I don't believe in that at all, and I think that it's good arguments to argue against. But we don't have an answer yet, and we will have an answer, I think, if it turns out that, for example, what we suggest that these fundamental constraints are operating, and eventually we develop a theory of saying, What is, from physics and complexity and information theory, what is the fundamental requirements that you need? Maybe this is very, very much constrained to something that might define what the starting point.
I mean, it would be astonishing if we did find examples of various origins of life here on Earth, and it turns out that we're not all from a common ancestor, then that really puts a lot of strength to this idea that there is a fundamental logic that over and over and over again, the laws of physics lead to the laws of chemistry, which lead to the same kind of life here on Earth. And we would assume then around the cosmos.
Yes. I guess that we have the possibility of actually testing this in a different way, which is on the one hand is this, the whole area of artificial life where, you know, people programming things that evolve very often get rid of things that we consider very much fundamental, like conservation of matter or things like that. And nevertheless, they have been finding very often things that are extremely familiar again. And on the other hand is the possibility for, and that's the breakthrough we are waiting for, that someone in the lab is able to actually build a living protocell. Because no matter what kind of things it's being observed, it will trigger a whole exploration, and eventually we'll have a really big understanding of what is the fundamental principles. And maybe that answers the question. I don't know.
Ricard, what are you obsessed with right now?
Well, there's plenty of problems that, I mean, my interest over the years has been to see there are general laws for the evolution and origins of complexity, which means natural and artificial. My interest is pretty much into understanding the space of the possible. And I'm saying that for many reasons. For example, when you ask someone define life, we went into usually a total chaos of definitions and very different points of view. And I think that this is because we are not addressing the question properly. I think that we have to build a space of possible lives. And this space is the answer. It's not a single way of defining life. The same happened with cognition, which is one of the topics we are exploring. And we propose this idea of going into looking at not only standard brains, but what we said, liquid brains, solutions that, you know, nature has found to make computations and change the environment. It could be ant colonies, for example, that in a way are like a brain, but there's no fixed neurons in fixed positions. And that makes a big difference in terms of the cognition that can emerge from there. And it's a fascinating project because you can mix a lot of things there, from with Joseph in the biosphere to artificial intelligence and what's going on right now, to the possibilities that I was mentioning before, that you can actually construct, you build in the lab, new kinds of cognition. So what is, again, it's my obsession, what is possible and what is not. And whether or not we can end up into general laws, like in physics, right, about the nature of life on different scales.
But I can imagine that you now find new logic blocks to think about in terms of even cognition, that, you know, my brain is communicating between neurons with electricity and various chemicals that are mediating the interactions, while an ant, for example, you've got, you know, it's more like a multi-core processor because each ant has its own neurons and has its own electrical impulses. But then you've got this, them being able to work in this more liquid fashion apart from each other, taking their consciousness farther away. You have an octopus that has shifted its cognition across its entire body as opposed to concentrating it in one area. But there must be this underlying logic, these fundamental properties across those different methods of cognition that still must adhere to the laws of physics.
Sure, yeah. And we are even interested in that problem across scales. One of the things we propose in the paper is that it's interesting to see that the fundamental units of cognition, neurons, are again used in a totally widespread way everywhere. And we suggest that this is probably because, it's again, if you want to build a system able to process information from cells, right? And neurons are a special case, which is beautifully indicating the function, right? When you see cells that store lipids or cells that play a role in somewhere else, the shapes sometimes suggest the shape of a neuron, which is, you know, a lot of kind of branches, but is saying that I'm searching for information, I'm searching to connect. And that solution that is a polar system that sends signals in one direction using threshold functions is repeatedly found out. And actually, when you look at gene networks, the logic is the same. And you look at the immune system, which is, again, a liquid brain, you also find the same when you describe mathematically. Kind of saying they are different systems, but again, in terms of the fundamental logic of how cognition is built, it's probably maybe a unique solution.
Fascinating. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today, and good luck with all of your research.
Thanks a lot.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Dr. Ricard Soleil. Now, we had a conversation where we went into the state of synthetic biology. How are scientists actually creating biological adaptations in the lab? How close are we to building self-replicating cells just from scratch? It was a really interesting conversation and went on for quite a while and was sort of different from this larger interview. And so we've made that available over on our Patreon channel. Now, this is available for free. You don't have to give us any money. You just have to follow us on Patreon. So if you go to patreon.com/universetoday, you'll see where you can follow us for free, and then you can get access to that additional interview. Now, I'm going to give you some final thoughts, but first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Adam Schaefer, Andrew Gross, Bear Lake Roofing, David Gilton, and David Matz, Dennis Alberti, Dustin Cable, James Clark, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Dahl Schultz, Paul Rohrbach, Sean Sargent, Spiderswap.io, Stephen Fowler-Munley, and Vlad Shiplin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level. And all our patrons, all your support means the universe to us. I'm really fascinated by this idea of abiogenesis, about us searching for life as we don't know it. And yet, when we think about how life on Earth is just this factory that is pushing evolution to the limit all the time. And so you would think that life has tried out every possible idea. And yet there are these constraints. There are these contingencies that life has to work with, has to deal with. It finds itself in these evolutionary minima, which it can't find its way out of again. And so, you know, is this all that's possible? Or if you ran the clock backwards, as Jay Gould famously said, would you get the same kinds of life forms here on Earth? If you would, then that tells us what to look for out there in the universe. And if you don't, then it shows us that life has many different ways to find a way. It's just that thanks to evolution and thanks to the way things worked out, we got what we got. And we still don't know, because we always just have this factor, this one factor of life here on Earth. And it's going to be fascinating as we continue our search out there across the universe. What will we find, and what will that tell us about life here on Earth? Now, I've done plenty of interviews on this subject, so I'll link a couple here in the final moments of this video. And if you want to learn more, you can just continue your rabbit hole journey down to the origins of life. Thanks. We'll see you next time.